KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Alex Albin says digital technology is leading to more connection and more alienation. Albin is the former Real Networks executive, a former candidate for Congress in the 8th Congressional District. And Alex Albin was a researcher for the legendary CBS newscaster Walter Cronkite. He also worked with Mike Wallace. He's been an entertainment lawyer specializing in intellectual property rights for both traditional and digital media. You maybe have read his guest columns in the Seattle Times, Alex Albin's new book, Analog Days, How Technology Rewrote the Future, and he's going to be on tour around the state for the next couple of years with a presentation on the impact of technology for Humanities Washington. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Ross. Good to be here.
You're such a young fellow. How old were you when you worked for Walter Cronkite?
I was 21, and I hadn't even graduated college, but I had this opportunity to go work for him in New York, and I just packed my bags up, literally said bye to my friends, and that was it. And within a few weeks, I was working for Cronkite, who at that point was called the most trusted man in America.
What was it like to work for him?
You know, he was really great to work for. He would call me down to do some, you know, fact-checking or whatever for the evening news. And I remember his producer would be there, who's a very senior executive at CBS. And then Cronkite would say, well, I'm sort of hungry before the show. Can someone get me a candy bar? So I'm the kid. I would get up and say, what kind of candy bar do you want? He said, no. You point to the producer. He said, you go get it. And that brought back to me, Ross, that he really cared about the facts and the fact checking. And at that, you know, moment before the news,
he wanted to talk to you.
He wanted to talk to me because I was telling him things that, you know, he needed to verify.
Interesting. Was he a tough boss?
You know, I worked for him his last year at CBS, and he really was avuncular. He really was very calm. And it was an era of news where you could have a most trusted man, where now, because of the fracturing of media, I don't think you can have that anymore.
And then you worked for Mike Wallace, who at least in his broadcast personality has kind of a reputation for being a hothead. How was that compared to working for Cronkite?
So it's funny how sometimes people have the opposite personality in real life. Mike was a very warm guy and personable and would put his arm around you. And he was also really concerned about the verity of things that we were doing. I worked on a documentary about Vietnam with him, and he would, you know, literally grab me on an airplane and say, Alex, I need to know, you know, why are these facts true? What was happening in Vietnam at that point? And is what we are saying in this show really accurate? And he cared about that, which was another good lesson for me.
Well, of course, CBS got in trouble with another documentary about Vietnam having to do with General Westmoreland.
Right.
That really kind of knocked Dan Rather's career for something. Having worked on the same kind of research, what were your reflections when that was on?
Well, I worked on that documentary.
Oh, you did?
And the documentary was sued for libel. And it was a moment of truth for CBS because we put a year and lots of money behind a documentary, which was really about an important episode in Vietnam, sort of how to measure how we're winning or not. And we were saying we're not winning. We had the wrong way of measuring enemy strength. And the interesting thing for me, the lesson in today's media, is that networks don't do that kind of documentary anymore, right? They don't devote millions of dollars to prove a historical point. Because the networks now are chasing ratings and they're chasing what's happening on the news. And, you know, if you look at what happened in Iraq, we would send correspondents into the field, right? And they now have cameras that are embedded with live video uplinks, with satellite uplinks, so that people can see the war firsthand, like they're eyewitnesses. But that, in a way, can be deceptive because are you really seeing what's happening in that war firsthand, or are you just seeing what that one camera is showing you? So that when the American troops were advancing and all of the Iraqi army was fleeing, literally abandoning their vehicles, you know, it gave people back home a chance to think, well, we're winning this war. But in fact, we weren't, right? In fact, the enemy soldiers were sort of melting away, and they were going to fight an insurgency against us for, you know, the next 7 years. So the fact that we have become so dependent on video and video that isn't even edited before you see it on cable news has really changed political reporting.
Alex Albin is my guest. Along with his work at CBS, he went on to Real Networks, and he's got a new book out. It's called Analog Days, How Technology Rewrote Our Future. And you write that with the rise of digital technology, we're kind of a fast twitch nation defined by a paradox. And the paradox is this. You say there's more connection and more alienation. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that a lot of us have friends in social networks. The average Facebook user today has 245 friends. Interestingly, your average friend on Facebook has 359 friends. And that's because you tend to be friends with people who are more social, who have more friends. So we have this illusion of friendship. And yet all of the statistics show, Ross, across the board, that people feel more alienated. The recent studies of people over 45 say that 60% of them feel lonely. And so we have this ability to connect online, and yet we really feel we have fewer close friends. So I'm not a sociologist, but I Sure. really thought that was interesting.
Well, people might feel more lonely, but why would we attribute that to being online and on Facebook? Could it not have to do with other factors?
Certainly other factors come into play.
Yeah.
More people live alone than ever before. And yet I think that there is this paradox of we have this illusion of friendship and this illusion of connection with people. And that's great. You know, when I want to send out a notice about, you know, a birthday or celebrating something, that's wonderful to be able to send it right away to your 200 friends. But you really still need that personal connection. And whether it's around the dinner table, you know, fighting that fight with your teenagers or not teenagers about who's texting at the table. I mean, I think these things are distractions and we need to get a hold of them. You know, I had this panic moment last year when I left my phone at home and I was going off to work. And, you know, you reach that 20-minute point where you say, well, I can't go back. Now, people didn't feel this way, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, right? There's been a lot of great technology, but if we had to live without our computer or without, you know, a typewriter, we could live with it, right? With these smartphones now, we really feel disconnected and personally even frightened to walk around, you know, without them. We feel like something's going to happen and I'm not going to know about it.
They are indeed the personal computers. There's that survey that showed that an incredible percentage of people with cell phones slept with them right by them. They really had to be close to their cell phone at night when they were sleeping. You've written that the mass culture of the baby boom generation that I'm part of has been replaced by a personal culture. What does that mean?
It means that media today is really tailored, even from preschool days, to who you are. So when I grew up in the 1960s, we would watch shows together, even with our parents, right? Even cartoons. That was the only thing on a Saturday morning. But now each of these cable networks is tailoring shows to the 3 to 5-year-old demographic, to the 7 to 10-year-old demographic. So kids growing up are getting bombarded with messages that are really targeted to them, that really talk to them. And yet they're becoming disassociated with their peers. And I think that this is going to have implications for our culture down the road.
But sometimes, to your example of people watching television, doesn't the multiple screens that we have allow people to be watching TV in different places but actually communicating about it at the same time, maybe with friends or during a debate, just reading what people are tweeting about it? Isn't there some kind of connection that's also going on there?
There is also connection, but it's different than having the communal experience. You know, when we used to have the three major networks, they would get, you know, 30, 40 million viewers for a popular show like Mary Tyler Moore or All in the Family. And that brought the family together, and then you could see each other, and then you could actually laugh together. And I'm really concerned that we don't have that kind of communal upbringing anymore, and it's a loss.
But don't the viral videos that go out there and streak across the world prompt conversations in real life afterwards?
Well, let's talk about viral video,
sure.
Some of which aren't really, you know, accurate. So one of the big problems now is how do we know what's true and what's not true that we see? You know, remember that photo that came out a few years ago was of a huge white shark that was jumping out of the water and a guy was on a helicopter ladder and the shark looked like he was getting him? Well, I sent that around. I thought, wow, this is an amazing photo. Well, that turns out to be a complete hoax. It was a photoshopped photo, and it just shows that without fact checkers anymore and without traditional media, we really don't know what we're seeing online.
Absolutely true. But I'm also thinking of Psy, the South Korean K-pop star and Gangnam Style that you cannot avoid. It's being parodied everywhere. And in some ways, this phenomenon of going out there, it's definitely Psy doing that dance. No one is accused of being a stunt double of doing the Silly Little Pony dance. And it's probably not that deep, but it's kind of created some connections that would have not existed before.
I think that's probably true. But, you know, every generation has its Elvis or has, you know, a pop star that's going to rise
and we've
to the
got
top.
Psy.
And we've got that. Are we better or worse off?
Alex Alban is my guest, former congressional candidate, Real Networks executive, touring the state for Humanities Washington to talk about how technology has changed our culture, a subject he's thought a lot about and written about. And you talk about analog values that you feel as though we're losing. What are those analog values you think are going away in this digital culture?
Well, I think one of the examples is my father was in the advertising business. He was he wrote some of the commercials for Timex. You know, takes a licking, keeps on ticking.
He was the guy.
He was the producer of those commercials. And in those days, they took a lot of time to produce something and to think about it and to vet it. And we don't have that anymore. We have this really fast twitch response, very little editorial control. We're in a world where trustworthy newspapers are really challenged and going out of business. And so one of the values simply is trust. Who do we trust? We also put this big premium on speed. You know, it's more important than ever to get it fast.
Yeah.
But are we really getting it right?
That's a great question. But at the same time, we're not rolling back. I don't see any kind of slow internet movement. I'm going to trade in my high-speed internet for slow internet, like slow cooking.
I have never met someone who would trade in a fast connection. But that raises this really interesting historical point. You know, people used to be called Luddites. And this goes back to a guy named Ned Ludd, who in 1779 in England saw that the mills and the automatic looms were threatening the livelihood of people who would, you know, do the hand looms for wool. So Ludd started breaking these new manufactured looms. And within 20 or 30 years, this turned into a movement where people would rebel against the Industrial Revolution. Well, we all know who won, right? The Industrial Revolution won. And yet this idea that there's a value to craftsmanship and that there's a value to an individual making his mark on a product, that's really important. So I'm not saying we're going to stop the tide. The tide has overwhelmed us, right? But what I'm saying is, shouldn't we pause, take a moment, and reflect on this huge change that we've all been through in the last 30 years and have this conversation about what are we missing? What was important to us that maybe there's another way to bring back? And that's the kind of conversation that I want to foster.
There's one aspect of digital culture that I find alarming, and it's the slander and the bullying that goes on. And I'm not just talking about the comments section of newspapers or other websites where people just get into completely anti-personal attacks. I'm talking about the individual, the vindictive ex-boyfriend who sets up a fake profile on an adult dating site for his ex-girlfriend, or college students who put videotaped sexual encounters of their roommates online, or the vicious campaigns by groups like Anonymous against people who they perceive as enemies. This certainly was possible to slander and trash talk people in the past, but now it goes worldwide. It goes worldwide instantly. And because of the very legal system that controls the internet, which is different than newspapers and broadcasters, you're not allowed to go after the entity that distributes the information. You can go after the person who did the slander or libel, but you can't go after Facebook. You can't go after a blog.
Right. And this came up with this poor girl named Megyn Kelly. It was about 4 or 5 years ago where a friend of hers, or so-called friend of hers, she was 16 years old, a girl in Missouri, created this fake boyfriend and then had that boyfriend break up with her. So it was a clear case of bullying and deception. And the poor girl ended up committing suicide over this. So that raised this question for lawyers and for policymakers is, what are we doing in this new environment, right? There was no law in the state of Missouri at that point for creating a fake identity, right, and exploiting it. And so the law, Ross, always is going to be behind the technology. And this has even happened on online networks in Japan and South Korea, where people have gotten divorced and they know that their spouse has a popular avatar that they've created. And so there was a case in Japan where the wife, estranged wife, killed the avatar of the husband after their divorce. And he sued, and she was put in jail. So we're beginning to blend virtual reality and actual reality. And can you be damaged by something that happens in virtual reality? Of course. But should the same laws apply? Should the same penalties apply? We don't know. And what I'm saying is that we really need to think hard about how to revise our legal system to come up with these new kind of crimes that we're encountering.
Alex Albin, as someone who worked as an attorney in digital and traditional media, I have to ask you about the strand of digital utopianism, which holds that information in all of its forms should be free. Copyright be damned. It's just slowing down the process, they would say. We need to kind of push it out there, interact with it, reposition it. I'm sure as an attorney, not been your position.
Well, I worked some of the first digital products at Starwave and at Real Networks, where people could actually download music and copy it and download it for free. So that's not right to steal some music that's held by another person or a company. And yet the problem really is, how do you create a new marketplace for these new products? Because, you know, the recording industry would try to sue individual users and saying, well, that was a copyrighted song and you've pirated it. And what we were trying to do, and Rob Glazer and the people at Real Networks for years, really tried to establish this legitimate marketplace, because good commerce is going to drive out piracy over time. And I think we've seen that now with the success of iTunes, which, you know, they sell over $3 billion worth of songs a year, right? The problem in the early days where I was working was that the labels and the movie studios were not licensing this stuff for people to buy. And then people ended up taking it for free.
Well, the music business still thinks that so much stuff is being stolen that they're collapsing.
The music business has always had a hard time with new technologies. And when we started doing internet radio, they imposed royalties on us that didn't even exist in terrestrial radio. So we would play the same songs as you would play over an AM or FM station, and we would have to pay this extra performance rate. That penalized the new medium. And so we went to Congress, and I testified before different congressional committees, and we said, let's at least have this level playing field here so that internet radio can compete with, you know, real radio, and then let's see who wins. And Ross, this is still the case. There is still this extra penalty on internet radio.
Alex Albin, thank you so much for stopping by. I appreciate it.
Great. It's been fun.
The new book is called Analog Days, How Technology Rewrote Our Future. Also, he's doing a speaking tour around the state with Humanities Washington. If you are a part of a nonprofit or a library, a group that would just like to have him come and talk about it, you can contact Humanities Washington about that. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.